Jason Debbins, who sat behind the wheel of a prison laundry truck and shot himself. And where else did he have to go then, except home? The breeze pressed softly against his cheek, and then died. He struck another match and dropped it. It landed in a small pool of gasoline, and the gas caught. The flames were blue. They spread out delicately, a kind of corona with the burned match stub at its center. Trashcan watched for a moment, paralyzed with fascination, and then he stepped quickly to the stairs that circled around the tank to the bottom, looking back over his shoulder. He could see the pumping machinery through a heat haze now, flickering back and forth like a mirage. The blue flames, no more than 2 inches high, spread toward the machinery and toward the open pipe in a widening semicircle. The bug's struggles had ended. It was nothing but a blackened husk. I could let that happen to me. But he didn't seem to want to. It seemed, vaguely, that there might be another purpose in his life now, something very grand and great. So he felt a touch of fear, and he began to descend the steps on the run, his shoes clanging, his hand slipping quickly over the steep, rust-pitted railing. Down and down, circling, wondering how long until the vapor hanging around the mouth of the outflow pipe would catch, how long before heat great enough for ignition would rush down the pipe's throat and into the tank's belly. Hair flying back from his forehead, a terrified grin pasted to his face, the wind roaring in his ears, he rushed down. Now he was halfway, racing past the letters CH, letters 20 feet high and lime green against the white of the tank. Down and down, and if his flying feet stuttered or caught on anything, he would tumble like the gas can had tumbled, his bones breaking like dead branches. The ground came closer, the white gravel circles around the tanks, the green grass beyond the gravel. The cars in the parking lot began to regain their normal size, and still he seemed to be floating, floating in a dream, and he would never reach the bottom, only run and run and get nowhere. He was next to a bomb, and the fuse was lit. From far overhead there came a sudden bang, like a 5-inch 4th of July firecracker. There was a dim clang, and then something whirred past him. It was part of the outflow pipe, he saw with a sharp and almost delicious fear. It was totally black and twisted into a new and excitingly senseless shape by the heat. He placed one hand on the railing and vaulted over, hearing something snap in his wrist. Sickening pain flowed up his arm to the elbow. He dropped the last 25 feet, landed on the gravel, and went sprawling. The gravel scraped skin from his forearms, but he hardly felt it. He was full of moaning, grinning panic now, and the day seemed very bright. Trashcan Man scrambled up, craning his head around and back, sending his gaze up even as he began to run again. The top of this middle tank had grown yellow hair, and the hair was growing at an amazing rate. The whole thing could blow at any second. He ran, his right hand flopping on its broken wrist. He leaped over the parking lot curb, and his feet slapped on asphalt. Now he was across the parking lot, his shadow trailing at his feet, and now he was running straight down the wide gravel access road and bolting through the half-open gate and back onto Highway 130. He ran straight across it and flung himself into the ditch on the far side, landing on a soft bed of dead leaves and wet moss, his arms wrapped around his head, the breath tearing in and out of his lungs like stabbing jackknives. The oil tank blew. Not wham, but kawhap. A sound so huge, yet at the same time so short and guttural that he felt his eardrums actually press in, and his eyeballs press out as the air somehow changed. A second explosion followed, then a third, and Trashcan writhed on the dead leaves and grinned and screamed soundlessly. He sat up, holding his hands over his ears, and sudden wind struck him and slapped him flat with such power that he might have been no more than a piece of litter. The young saplings behind him bent over backward, and their leaves made a frantic whirring sound, like the pennants over a used car lot on a windy day. One or two snapped with small cracking sounds, as if someone was shooting a target pistol. Burning pieces of the tank started to fall on the other side of the road, some actually on the road. They hit with a clanging noise, the rivets still hanging in some of the chunks of metal, twisted and black, as the outflow pipe had been. Kawham! Trashcan sat up again and saw a gigantic fire tree beyond the Cheery Oil parking lot. Black smoke was billowing from its top, rising straight to an amazing height before the wind could disrupt it and rafter it away. You couldn't look at it without squinting your eyes almost shut, and now there was radiant heat baking across the road at him, tightening his skin, making it feel shiny. His eyes were gushing water in protest. Another burning chunk of metal, this one better than 7 feet across at its widest, and shaped like a diamond, fell out of the sky, landed in the ditch 20 feet to his left, and the dry leaves on top of the wet moss were instantly ablaze. Kawham! Kawham! If he stayed here, he would go up in a jigging, screaming blaze of spontaneous combustion. He scrambled to his feet and began to run along the shoulder of the highway in the direction of Gary, the breath getting hotter and hotter in his lungs. The air had begun to taste like heavy metal. Presently, he began to feel his hair to see if he had started burning. The sweet stench of gasoline filled the air, seeming to coat him. Hot wind ripped his clothes. He felt like something trying to escape from a microwave oven. The road doubled before his watering eyes, then trebled. There was another coughing roar as rising air pressure caused the Cheery Oil Company office building to implode. Scimitars of glass wickered through the air. Chunks of concrete and cinder block rained out of the sky and hailed on the road. A whizzing piece of steel about the size of a quarter and the thickness of a Mars bar sliced through Trashcan's shirt sleeve and made a thin scrape on his skin. A piece big enough to have turned his head to guava jelly struck in front of his feet and then bounded away, leaving a good-sized crater behind. Then he was beyond the fallout zone, still running, the blood beating in his head as if his very brain had been sprayed with number 2 heating oil and then set ablaze. Kawham! That was another one of the tanks, and the air resistance in front of him seemed to disappear, and a large warm hand pushed him firmly from behind, a hand that fitted every contour of his body from heels to head. It shoved him forward with his toes barely touching the road, and now his face bore the terrified, pan-sweating grin of someone who has been attached to the world's biggest kite in a high cap of wind, and let loose to fly, fly, baby, up into the sky until the wind goes somewhere else, leaving him to scream all the way down in a helpless power dive. From behind a perfect fusillade of explosions, God's ammunition dump going up in the flames of righteousness, Satan storming heaven, his artillery captain a fiercely grinning fool with red flayed cheeks, Trash Can Man by name, never to be Donald Merwin Elbert again. Sights jittering by, cars wrecked off the road, Mr. Strang's blue mailbox with the flag up, a dead dog with its legs up, a power line down in a cornfield. The hand was not pushing him quite so hard now. Resistance had come back in front. Trash risked a glance back over his shoulder and saw that the knoll where the oil tanks had stood was a mass of fire. Everything was burning. The road itself seemed to be on fire back there, and he could see the summer trees going up like torches. He ran another quarter mile, then dropped into a puffing, blowing, shambling walk. A mile farther on, he rested, looking back, smelling the glad smell of burning. With no fire trucks and firefighters to put it out, it would go whatever way the wind took it. It might burn for months. Powtonville would go, and the fire line would march south, destroying houses, villages, farms, crops, meadows, forests. It might get as far south as Terre Haute, and it would burn that place he had been in. It might burn farther. In fact, his eyes turned north again, toward Gary. He could see the town now, its great stacks standing quiet and blameless, like strokes of chalk on a light blue blackboard. Chicago beyond that. How many oil tanks? How many gas stations? How many trains standing silent on sidings full of LP gas and flammable fertilizer? How many slums as dry as kindling? How many cities beyond Gary and Chicago? There was a whole country ripe for burning under the summer sun. Grinning, Trashcan Man got to his feet and began to walk. His skin was already going lobster red. He didn't feel it, although that night it would keep him awake in a kind of exaltation. There were bigger and better fires ahead. His eyes were soft and joyful and utterly crazy. They were the eyes of a man who has discovered the great axle of his destiny and has laid his hands upon it. Chapter 35. I want to get out of the city, Rita said without turning around. She was standing on the small apartment balcony, the early morning breeze catching the diaphanous nightgown she wore, blowing yards of the material back through the sliding doors. All right, Larry said. He was sitting at the table, eating a fried egg sandwich. She turned to him, her face haggard. If she had looked an elegant 40 in the park the day he had met her, she now looked like a woman dancing on the chronological knife edge that separates the early 60s from the late. There was a cigarette between her fingers, and the tip trembled, making jitters of smoke, as she brought it to her lips and puffed without inhaling. I mean it, I'm serious. He used his napkin. I know you are, he said, and I can dig it, we have to go. Her facial muscles sagged into something like relief, and with an almost but not quite subconscious distaste, Larry thought it made her look even older. When? Why not today? He asked. You're a dear boy, she said. Would you like more coffee? I can get it. Nonsense. You sit right where you are. I always used to get my husband a second cup. He insisted on it, although I never saw more than his hairline at breakfast. The rest of him was behind the Wall Street Journal or some dreadful heavy piece of literature, something not just meaningful or deep, but positively gravid with meaning. Bull, Camus, Milton, for God's sake. You're a welcome change. She looked back over her shoulder on the way to the kitchenette. Her expression was arch. It would be a shame to hide your face behind a newspaper. He smiled vaguely. Her wit seemed forced this morning, as it had all yesterday afternoon. He remembered meeting her in the park and how he had thought her conversation seemed like a careless spray of diamonds on the green felt of a billiard table. Since yesterday afternoon it had seemed more like the glitter of zircons, near-perfect pastes that were, after all, only pastes. Here you are. She went to set the cup down, and her hand, still trembling, caused hot coffee to slop out onto the side of his forearm. He jerked back from her with an indrawn feline hiss of pain. Oh, I'm sorry. Something more than consternation on her face. There was something there which could almost be terror. It's all right. No, I'll just... A cold rag. Don't... Sit right there. Clumsy. Stupid. She burst into tears, harsh caws escaping her as if she had witnessed the messy death of her best friend instead of burning him slightly. He got to his feet and held her, and didn't much care for the convulsive way she hugged him in return. It was almost a clutch. Cosmic Clutch. The new album by Larry Underwood, he thought unhappily. Oh, shit. You ain't no nice guy. Here we go again.
I'm sorry. I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm never like this. I'm so sorry.
It's all right. It's nothing. He went on soothing her automatically, brushing his hand over her salt and pepper hair that would look so much better. All of her would look better, as a matter of fact, after she had put in some heavy time in the bathroom. Of course, he knew what part of the trouble was. It was both personal and impersonal. It had affected him, too, but not so suddenly or deeply. With her, it was as if some internal crystal had shattered in the last 20 hours or so. Impersonally, he supposed, it was the smell. It was coming in through the opening between the apartment living room and the balcony right now, riding the cool early morning breeze that would later give way to still, humid heat, if this day was anything like the last 3 or 4. The smell was hard to define in any way that could be correct, yet less painful than the naked truth. You could say it was like moldy oranges, or spoiled fish, or the smell you sometimes got in subway tunnels when the windows were open. None of them were exactly right. That it was the smell of rotting people, thousands of them, decomposing in the heat behind closed doors, was putting it right. but you wanted to shy away from that. The power was still on in Manhattan, but Larry didn't think it would be for much longer. It had gone out in most other places already. Last night he had stood on the balcony after Rita was asleep, and from this high up you could see that the lights were out in better than half of Brooklyn and all of Queens. There was a dark pocket across 110th all the way to that end of Manhattan Island. Looking the other way, you could still see bright lights in Union City and, maybe, Bayonne, but otherwise, New Jersey was black. The blackness meant more than the loss of lights. Among other things, it meant the loss of the air conditioning, the modern convenience that made it possible to live in this particular hardcore urban sprawl after the middle of June. It meant that all the people who had died quietly in their apartments and tenements were now rotting in ovens, and whenever he thought of that, his mind returned to the thing he had seen in the comfort station on Transverse Number 1. He had dreamed about that, and in his dreams that black, sweet treat came to life and beckoned him. On a more personal level, he supposed she was troubled by what they had found when they walked down to the park yesterday. She had been laughing and chatty and gay when they started out, but coming back she had begun to be old. The monster shouter had been lying on one of the paths in a huge pool of his own blood. His glasses lay with both lenses shattered beside his stiff and outstretched left hand. Some monster had been abroad after all, apparently. The man had been stabbed repeatedly. To Larry's sickened eyes, he had looked like a human pincushion. She had screamed and screamed, and when her hysteria had finally quieted, she insisted that they bury him. So they had. And going back to the apartment, she had been the woman he had found this morning. "It's all right," he said. "Just a little scald. The skin's hardly red." "I'll get the unguentine. There's some in the medicine cabinet." She started away, and he grabbed her firmly by the shoulders and made her sit down. She looked up at him from darkly circled eyes. "What you're going to do is eat," he said. "Scrambled eggs, toast, coffee. Then we're going to get some maps and see what's the best way to get off Manhattan. We'll have to walk, you know."
"Yes, I suppose we will."
He went into the kitchenette, not wanting to look at the mute need in her eyes anymore, and got the last two eggs from the refrigerator. He cracked them into a bowl, tossed the eggshells into the disposal, and began to beat them. "Where do you want to go?" he asked.
"What? I don't..."
"Which way?" he said with a touch of impatience. He added milk to the eggs and put the skillet back on the stove. "North? New England's that way. South? I don't really see the point in that. We could go..." A strangled sob. He turned and saw her looking at him, her hands warring with each other in her lap, her eyes shiny. She was trying to control herself and having no luck. "What's the matter?" he asked, going to her. "What is it?"
"I don't think I can eat," she sobbed. "I know you want me to. I'll try, but the smell..."
He crossed the living room, trundled the glass doors closed along their stainless steel tracks, then latched them firmly. "There," he said lightly, hoping the annoyance he felt with her didn't show. "Better?"
"Yes," she said eagerly. "That's a lot better. I can eat now."
He went back to the kitchenette and stirred the eggs, which had begun to bubble. There was a grater in the utensil drawer, and he ran a block of American cheese along it, making a small pile that he sprinkled into the eggs. Behind him she moved, and a moment later Debussy filled the apartment, too light and pretty for Larry's taste. He didn't care for light classical music. If you were going to have classical shit, you ought to go whole hog and have your Beethoven or your Wagner or someone like that. Why fuck around? She had asked him in a casual manner what he did for a living. The casual manner, he reflected with some resentment, of a person for whom anything so simple as a living had never been a problem. "I was a rock and roll singer," he told her, slightly amazed at how painless that past tense was. "Sing with this band for a while, then that one. Sometimes a studio gig." She had nodded, and that was the end of it. He had no urge to tell her about "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?" That was the past now. The gap between that life and this was so large he hadn't really comprehended it yet. In that life, he had been running away from a cocaine dealer. In this one, he could bury a man in Central Park and accept that, more or less, as a matter of course. He put the eggs on a plate, added a cup of instant coffee with a lot of cream and sugar, the way she liked it. Larry himself subscribed to the trucker's credo of, if you wanted a cup of cream and sugar, why'd you ask for coffee? And brought it to the table. She was sitting on a hassock, holding her elbows and facing the stereo. WC strained out of the speakers like melted butter. Soup's on, he called. She came to the table with a wan smile, looked at the eggs the way a track and field runner might look at a series of hurdles, and began to eat.
Good, she said. You are right, thank you.
You're more than welcome, he said. Now look. What I'm going to suggest is this. We go down 5th to 39th and turn west. Cross to New Jersey by the Lincoln Tunnel. We can follow 495 northwest of Passaic and... Those eggs okay? They're not spoiled? She smiled.
They're fine.
She forked more into her mouth, followed it with a sip of coffee.
Just what I needed. Go ahead, I'm listening.
From Passaic, we just ankle it west until the roads are clear enough for us to drive. Then I thought we could turn northeast and head up to New England. Make kind of a button hook, do you see what I mean? It looks longer, but I think it'll end up saving us a lot of hassles. Maybe take a house on the ocean in Maine. Kittery, York, Wells, Agunquit. Maybe Scarborough or Booth Bay Harbor. How does that sound? He had been looking out the window, thinking as he spoke, and now he turned back to her. What he saw frightened him badly for a moment. It was as if she'd gone insane. She was smiling, but it was a rictus of pain and horror. Sweat stood out on her face in big round droplets.
Rita? Jesus, Rita, what? Sorry.
She scrambled up, knocking her chair over, and fled across the living room. One foot hooked the hassock she had been sitting on, and it rolled on its side like an oversized checker. She almost fell herself.
Rita?
Then she was in the bathroom, and he could hear the industrial grinding sound of her breakfast coming up. He slammed his hand flat on the table in irritation, then got up and went in after her. God, he hated it when people puked. It always made you feel like puking yourself. The smell of slightly used American cheese in the bathroom made him want to gag. Rita was sitting on the robin's egg blue tile of the floor, her legs folded under her, her head still hanging weakly over the bowl. She wiped her mouth with a swatch of toilet paper and then looked up at him supplicatingly, her face as pale as paper.
I'm sorry. I just couldn't eat it, Larry. Really, I'm so sorry.
Well, Jesus, if you knew it was going to make you do that, why did you try?
Because you wanted me to. And I didn't want you to be angry with me. But you are, aren't you? You are angry with me.
His mind went back to last night. She had made love to him with such frantic energy that for the first time he had found himself thinking of her age and had been a little disgusted. It had been like being caught in one of those exercise machines. He had come quickly, almost in self-defense, it seemed, and a long while later she had fallen back, panting and unfulfilled. Later, while he was on the borderline of sleep, she had drawn close to him, and once again he had been able to smell her sachet, a more expensive version of scent his mother had always worn when they went out to the movies, and she had murmured the thing that had jerked him back from sleep and had kept him awake for another 2 hours.
You won't leave me, will you? You won't leave me alone?
Before that, she had been good in bed, so good that he was stunned. She had taken him back to this place after their lunch on the day they had met, and what had happened quite naturally. He remembered an instant of disgust when he saw how her breasts sagged and how the blue veins were prominent. It made him think of his mother's varicose veins. But he had forgotten all about that when her legs came up and her thighs pressed against his hips with amazing strength.
Slow, she had laughed. The last shall be first and the first last.
He had been on the verge when she had pushed him off and gotten cigarettes. What the hell are you doing? He asked, amazed, while old John Thomas waved indignantly in the air, visibly throbbing. She had smiled. You've got a free hand, don't you?
So do I.
So they had done that while they smoked, and she chatted lightly about all manner of things, although the color had come off in her cheeks, and after a while her breath had shortened, and what she was saying began to drift off, forgotten.
"Now," she said, taking his cigarette and her own and crushing them both out, "let's see if you can finish what you started. If you can't, I'll likely tear you apart."
He finished it, quite satisfactorily for both of them, and they had slipped off to sleep. He woke up some time after 4, watching her sleeping, thinking that there was something to be said for experience after all. He had done a lot of screwing in the last 10 years or so, but what had happened earlier hadn't been screwing. It had been something much better than that, if a little decadent. Well, she's had lovers, of course. This had excited him again, and he woke her up. And so it had been until they had found the monster shouter, and last night. There had been other things before then, things that troubled him, but which he had accepted. Something like this, he had rationalized it. If it only makes you a little bit psycho, you're way ahead. 2 nights ago he had awakened sometime after 2 and had heard her running a glass of water in the bathroom. He knew she was probably taking another sleeping pill. She had the big red and yellow gelatin capsules that were known as yellow jackets on the West Coast. Big downers. He told himself she'd probably been taking them long before the superflu had happened. And there was the way she followed him from place to place in the apartment, too, even standing in the bathroom door and talking to him while he was showering or relieving himself. He was a private bathroom person, but he told himself that some weren't. A lot of it depended on your upbringing. He would have a talk with her. Sometime. But now? Was he going to have to carry her on his back? Christ, he hoped not. She had seemed stronger than that, at least she had at first. It was one of the reasons she had appealed to him so strongly that day in the park. The main reason, really. There's no more truth in advertising, he thought bitterly. How the hell was he qualified to take care of her when he couldn't even watch out for himself? He'd shown that pretty conclusively after the record had broken out. Wayne Stuckey hadn't been shy about pointing it out, either. No, he told her, I'm not angry, it's just that, you know, I'm not your boss. If you don't feel like eating, just say so. I told you, I said I didn't think I could. The fuck you did, he snapped, startled and angry. She bent her head and looked at her hands, and he knew she was struggling to keep from sobbing, because he wouldn't like that. For a moment it made him angrier than ever, and he almost shouted, I'm not your father or your fat cat husband. I'm not going to take care of you. You've got 30 years on me, for Christ's sake. Then he felt the familiar surge of self-contempt and wondered what the hell could be the matter with him. I'm sorry, he said. I'm an insensitive bastard. No, you're not, she said, and sniffled. It's just that all of this is starting to catch up with me. Yesterday, that poor man in the park. I thought no one is ever going to catch the people who did that to him and put them in jail. They'll just go on and do it again and again, like animals in the jungle. And it all began to seem very real. Do you understand, Larry? Can you see what I mean? She turned her tear-wet eyes up to him. Yes, he said, but he was still impatient with her, and just a trifle contemptuous. It was a real situation, how could it not be? They were in the middle of it and had watched it develop this far. His own mother was dead, he had watched her die. And was she trying to say that she was somehow more sensitive to all this than he was? He had lost his mother, and she had lost the man who brought her Mercedes around, but somehow her loss was supposed to be the greater. Well, that was bullshit, just bullshit.
Try not to be angry with me, she said. I'll do better.
I hope so. I sure do hope so. You're fine, he said, and helped her to her feet. Come on now, what do you say? We've got a lot to do. Feel up to it?
Yes, she said, but her expression was the same as it had been when he offered her the eggs.
When we get out of the city, you'll feel better. She looked at him nakedly.
Will I?
Sure, Larry said heartily. Sure you will. They went first cabin. Manhattan Sporting Goods was locked, but Larry broke a hole in the show window with a long iron pipe he had found. The burglar alarm brayed senselessly into the deserted street. He selected a large pack for himself and a smaller one for Rita. She had packed 2 changes of clothes for each of them. It was all he would allow. And he was carrying them in a Pan Am flight bag she had found in the closet, along with toothbrushes. The toothbrushes struck him as slightly absurd. Rita was fashionably attired for walking, in white silk deck pants and a shell blouse. Larry wore faded blue jeans and a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up. They loaded the packs with freeze-dried foods and nothing else. There was no sense, Larry told her, in weighting themselves down with a lot of other stuff, including more clothes, when they could simply take what they wanted on the other side of the river. She agreed wanly, and her lack of interest nettled him again. After a short interior debate with himself, he also added a 30-30 and 200 rounds of ammunition. It was a beautiful gun, and the price tag he pulled from the trigger guard and dropped indifferently on the floor said $450. "Do you really think we'll need that?" she asked apprehensively. She still had the 32 in her purse. "I think we'd better have it," he told her, not wanting to say more but thinking about the monster shouter's ugly end. "Oh," she said in a small voice, and he guessed from her eyes that she was thinking about that too. "That pack's not too heavy for you, is it?"
"Oh, no, it isn't, really."
"Well, they have a way of getting heavier as you walk along. You just say the word and I'll carry it for a while."
"I'll be all right," she said, and smiled.
After they were on the sidewalk again, she looked both ways and said,
"We're leaving New York."
"Yes." She turned to him.
"I'm glad. I feel like, oh, when I was a little girl, and my father would say, 'We're going on a trip today.' Do you remember how that was?"
Larry smiled a little in return, remembering the evenings his mother would say, "That Western you wanted to see us down at the Crest, Larry? Clint Eastwood. What do you say?" "I guess I do remember," he said. She stretched up on her toes and readjusted the pack a little bit on her shoulders. "The beginning of a journey," she said, and then so softly he wasn't sure he'd heard her correctly.
"The way leads ever on."
"What?"
"It's a line from Tolkien," she said, "The Lord of the Rings. I've always thought of it as sort of a gateway to adventure."
"The less adventure, the better," Larry said, but almost unwillingly he knew what she meant. Still, she was looking at the street. Near this intersection, it was a narrow canyon between high stone and stretches of sun-reflecting thermopane, clogged with cars backed up for miles. It was as if everyone in New York had decided at the same time to park in the streets. She said, "I've been to Bermuda and England and Jamaica and Montreal and Saigon and to Moscow, but I haven't been on a journey since I was a little girl and my father took my sister Bess and me to the zoo. Let's go, Larry." It was a walk that Larry Underwood never forgot. He found himself thinking that she hadn't been so wrong to quote Tolkien at that. Tolkien with his mythic lands seen through the lens of time and half-mad, half-exalted imaginings, peopled with elves and ents and trolls and orcs. There were none of those in New York, but so much had changed, so much was out of joint, that it was impossible not to think of it in terms of fantasy. A man hung from a lamppost at 5th and East 54th, below the park and in a once-congested business district, a placard with the single word "looter" hung around his neck. A cat lying on top of a hexagonal litter basket. The basket still had fresh-looking advertisements for a Broadway show on its sides. With her kittens, giving them suck and enjoying the mid-morning sun. A young man with a big grin and a valise who strolled up to them and told Larry he would give him $1 million for the use of the woman for 15 minutes. The million, presumably, was in the valise. Larry unslung the rifle and told him to take his million elsewhere.
"Sure, man, don't hold it against me, you dig it? Can't blame a guy for trying, can you? Have a nice day, hang loose."
They reached the corner of 5th and East 39th shortly after meeting that man. Rita, with a hysterical sort of good humor, insisted on referring to him as John Beresford Tipton, a name which meant nothing to Larry. It was nearly noon, and Larry suggested lunch. There was a delicatessen on the corner, but when he pushed the door open, the smell of rotted meat that came out made her draw back.
"I'd better not go in there if I want to save what appetite I have," she said apologetically.
Larry suspected he could find some cured meat inside—salami, pepperoni, something like that. But after running across John Beresford Tipton 4 blocks back, he didn't want to leave her alone for even the short time it would take to go in and check. So they found a bench 1/2 block west and ate dehydrated fruit and dehydrated strips of bacon. They finished with cheese spread on Ritz crackers and passed a thermos of iced coffee back and forth. "This time I was really hungry," she said proudly. He smiled back, feeling better. Just to be on the move, to take some positive action, that was good. He had told her she would feel better when they got out of New York. At the time it had just been something to say. Now, consulting the rise in his own spirits, he guessed it was true. Being in New York was like being in a graveyard where the dead were not yet quiet. The sooner they got out, the better it would be. She would perhaps revert to the way she had been that first day in the park. They would go to Maine on the secondary roads and set up housekeeping in one of those rich bitch summer houses. North now, and south in September or October. Booth Bay Harbor in the summer, Key Biscayne in the winter. It had a nice ring. Occupied with his thoughts, he didn't see her grimace of pain as he stood up and shouldered the rifle he had insisted on bringing. They were moving west now, their shadows behind them, at first as squat as frogs, beginning to lengthen out as the afternoon progressed. They passed the Avenue of the Americas, 7th Avenue, 8th, 9th, 10th. The streets were crammed and silent, frozen rivers of automobiles in every color, predominated by the yellow of the taxicabs. Many of the cars had become hearses, their decaying drivers still leaning behind the wheels, their passengers slumped as if, weary of the traffic jam, they had fallen asleep. Larry started to think that maybe they'd want to pick up a couple of motorcycles once they got out of the city. That would give them both mobility and a fighting chance to skirt the worst of the clots of dead vehicles which must litter the highways everywhere. Always assuming she can run a bike, he thought, and the way things were going, it would turn out she couldn't. Life with Rita was turning out to be a real pain in the butt, at least in some of its aspects. But if push came to shove, he supposed she could ride Pillion behind him. At the intersection of 39th and 7th, they saw a young man wearing cut-off denim shorts and nothing else lying atop a ding-dong taxi. "Is he dead?" Rita asked. And at the sound of her voice, the young man sat up, looked around, saw them, and waved. They waved back. The young man lay placidly back down. It was just after 2 o'clock when they crossed 11th Avenue. Larry heard a muffled cry of pain behind him, and realized Rita was no longer walking on his left. She was down on one knee, holding her foot. With something like horror, Larry noticed for the first time that she was wearing expensive open-toed sandals, probably in the $80 range, just the thing for a 4-block stroll along 5th Avenue while window shopping. But for a long walk, a hike really, like the one they had been making. The ankle straps had chafed through her skin. Blood was trickling down her ankles.
"Larry, he
jerked her abruptly to her feet.
"What were you thinking about?" he shouted into her face.
He felt a moment's shame at the miserable way she recoiled, but also a mean sort of pleasure.
"Did you think you could cab back to your apartment if your feet got tired?"
"I never thought, well, Christ!" He ran his hands through his hair.
"I guess you didn't. You're bleeding, Rita. How long has it been hurting?"
Her voice was so low and husky that he had trouble hearing her even in the preternatural silence.
Since about 5th and 49th, I guess."
"Your feet have been hurting you for 20 fucking blocks and you didn't say anything?"
"I thought it might go away, not hurt anymore. I didn't want to. We were making such good time getting out of the city. I just thought..."
"You didn't think at all," he said angrily. "How much good time are we going to make with you like this? Your fucking feet look like you got fucking crucified."
"Don't swear at me, Larry," she said, beginning to sob. "Please don't. It makes me feel so bad when you... Please don't swear at me."
He was in an ecstasy of rage now, and later he would not be able to understand why the sight of her bleeding feet had blown all his circuits that way. For the moment, it didn't matter. He screamed into her face, "Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!" The word echoed back from the high-rise apartment buildings, dim and meaningless. She put her hands over her face and leaned forward, crying. It made him even angrier, and he supposed that part of it was that she really didn't want to see. She would just as soon put her hands over her face and let him lead her. Why not? There had always been someone around to take good care of our heroine, little Rita. Someone to drive the car, do the marketing, wash out the toilet bowl, do the taxes. So let's put on some of that gagging sweet WC and put our well-manicured hands over our eyes and leave it all up to Larry. Take care of me, Larry. After seeing what happened to the monster shouter, I've decided I don't want to see any more. It's all rather sordid for one of my breeding and background. He yanked her hands away. She cringed and tried to put them over her eyes again. Look at me. She shook her head. God damn it, you look at me, Rita. She finally did in a strange, flinching way, as if thinking he would now go to work on her with his fists as well as his tongue. The way a part of him felt now, that would be just fine. I want to tell you the facts of life because you don't seem to understand them. The fact is, we may have to walk another 20 or 30 miles. The fact is, if you get infected from those scrapes, you could get blood poisoning and die. The fact is, you've got to get your thumb out of your ass and start helping me. He had been holding her by the upper arms, and he saw that his thumbs had almost disappeared into her flesh. His anger broke when he saw the red marks that appeared when he let her go. He stepped away, feeling uncertain again, knowing with sick certainty that he had overreacted. Larry Underwood strikes again. If he was so goddamn smart, why hadn't he checked out her footgear before they started out? Because that's her problem, part of him said with surly defensiveness. No, that wasn't true. It had been his problem. Because she didn't know. If he was going to take her with him, and it was only today that he had begun to think how much simpler life would be if he hadn't, he was just going to have to be responsible for her. Be damned if I will, the surly voice said. His mother. You're a taker, Larry. The oral hygienist from Fordham crying out her window after him. I thought you were a nice guy. You ain't no nice guy. There's something left out of you, Larry. You're a taker. That's a lie. That is a goddamned lie. Rita, he said, I'm sorry. She sat down on the pavement in her sleeveless blouse and her white deck pants, her hair looking gray and old. She bowed her head and held her hurt feet. She wouldn't look at him. I'm sorry, he repeated. Look, I had no right to say those things. He did, but never mind. If you apologized, things got smoothed over. It was how the world worked. Go on, Larry, she said. Don't let me slow you down. I said I was sorry, he told her, his voice a trifle petulant. We'll get you some new shoes and some white socks. We'll nothing. Go on. Rita, I'm sorry. If you say that one more time, I'll scream. You're a shit, and your apology is not accepted. Now go on. I said I was... She threw back her head and shrieked. He took a step backward, looking around to see if anyone had heard her, to see if maybe a policeman was running over to see what kind of awful thing that young fellow was doing to the old lady who was sitting on the sidewalk with her shoes off. Culture lag, he thought distractedly. What fun it all is. She stopped screaming and looked at him. She made a flicking gesture with her hand, as if he was a bothersome fly. You better stop, he said, or I really will leave you. She only looked at him. He couldn't meet her eyes and so dropped his gaze, hating her for making him do that. All right, he said, have a good time getting raped and murdered. He shouldered the rifle and started off again, now angling left toward the car-packed 495 entrance ramp, sloping down toward the tunnel's mouth. At the foot of the ramp, he saw there had been one hell of a crash. A man driving a Mayflower moving van had tried to butt his way into the main traffic flow, and cars were scattered around the van like bowling pins. A burned-out Pinto lay almost beneath the van's body. The van's driver hung halfway out of the cab window, head down, arms dangling. There was a fan of dried blood and puke sprayed out below him on the door. Larry looked around, sure he would see her walking toward him or standing and accusing him with her eyes. But Rita was gone. Fuck you, he said with nervous resentment. I tried to apologize. For a moment he couldn't go on. He felt impaled by hundreds of angry dead eyes staring out at him from all these cars. A snatch of Dylan occurred to him. "I waited for you inside the frozen traffic, when you knew I had some other place to be. But where are you tonight, sweet Marie?" Ahead, he could see four lanes of westbound traffic disappearing into the black arch of the tunnel, and with something like real dread, he saw that the overhead fluorescent bars inside the Lincoln were out. It would be like going into an automobile graveyard. They would let him get halfway, and then they would all begin to stir, to come alive. He would hear car doors clicking open and then softly chunking closed, their shuffling footsteps. A light sweat broke on his body. Overhead, a bird called raucously, and he jumped. "You're being stupid," he told himself. "Kid stuff, that's what this is. All you have to do is stay on the pedestrian catwalk, and in no time at all you'll be strangled by the walking dead." He licked his lips and tried to laugh. It came out badly. He walked 5 paces toward the place where the ramp joined the highway, and then stopped again. To his left was a caddy, an Eldorado, and a woman with a blackened troll face was staring out at him. Her nose was pressed into a bulb against the glass. Blood and snot had trickled out onto the window. The man who had been driving the caddy was slumped over the wheel as if looking for something on the floor. All the caddy's windows were rolled up. It would be like a greenhouse in there. If he opened the door, the woman would spill out and break open on the pavement like a sack of rotten melons, and the smell would be warm and steamy, wet and crawling with decay. The way it would smell in the tunnel. Abruptly, Larry turned around and trotted back the way he had come, feeling the breeze he was making cool the sweat on his forehead.
"Rita! Rita, listen, I want to—"
The words died as he reached the top of the ramp. Rita was still gone. 39th Street dwindled away to a point. He ran from the south sidewalk to the north, squeezing between bumpers and scrambling over hoods almost hot enough to blister his skin. But the north sidewalk was also empty. He cupped his hands around his mouth and cried, "Rita! Rita!" His only answer, a dead echo.
"Rita! Ida! Ida! Ida!"
By 4 o'clock, dark clouds had begun to build over Manhattan, and the sound of thunder rolled back and forth between the city's cliffs. Lightning forked down at the buildings. It was as if God were trying to frighten the few remaining people out of hiding. The light had become yellow and strange, and Larry didn't like it. His belly was cramped, and when he lit a cigarette, it trembled in his hand the way the coffee cup had trembled in Rita's this morning. He was sitting at the street end of the access ramp, leaning his pack against the lowest bar of the railing. His pack was on his lap, and the 30-30 was leaning against the railing beside him. He had thought she would get scared and come back before long, but she hadn't. 15 minutes ago, he had given up calling her name. The echoes freaked him out. Thunder rolled again, close this time. A chilly breeze ran its hand over the back of his shirt, which was pasted to his skin with sweat. He was going to have to get inside somewhere, or else stop shitting around and go through the tunnel. If he couldn't work up the guts to go through, he'd have to spend another night in the city and go over the George Washington Bridge in the morning, and that was 140 blocks north. He tried to think rationally about the tunnel. There was nothing in there that was going to bite him. He'd forgotten to pick up a good big flashlight. Christ, you never remembered everything. But he did have his butane Bic, and there was a guardrail between the catwalk and the road. Anything else? Thinking about all those dead people in their cars, for instance, that was just panic talking, comic book stuff, about as sensible as worrying about the boogeyman in the closet. "If that's all you can think about, Larry," he lectured himself, "then you're not going to get along in this brave new world. Not at all. You're—" A stroke of lightning split the sky almost directly overhead, making him wince. It was followed by a heavy caisson of thunder. He thought randomly, "July 1st. This is the day you're supposed to take your sweetie to Coney Island and eat hot dogs by the score. Knock down the 3 wooden milk bottles with 1 ball and win the Cupid doll. The fireworks at night." A cold splash of rain struck the side of his face, and then another hit the back of his neck and trickled inside the collar of his shirt. Dime-sized drops began to hit around him. He stood up, slung the pack over his shoulders, and hoisted the rifle. He was still not sure which way to go, back to 39th or into the Lincoln Tunnel. But he had to get under cover somewhere because it was starting to pour. Thunder broke overhead with a gigantic roar, making him squeal in terror, a sound no different than those made by Cro-Magnon men 2 million years before. "You fucking coward," he said, and trotted down the ramp toward the maw of the tunnel. His head bent forward as the rain began to come harder. It dripped from his hair. He passed the woman with her nose against the Eldorado's passenger window, trying not to look, but catching her out of the tail of his eye just the same. The rain drummed on the car roofs like jazz percussion. It was coming down so hard it bounced back up again, causing a light mist haze. Larry stopped for a moment just outside the tunnel, undecided and frightened again. Then it began to hail, and that decided him. The hailstones were big, stinging. Thunder bellowed again. "Okay," he thought. "Okay, okay, okay, I'm convinced." He stepped into the Lincoln Tunnel. It was much blacker inside than he had imagined it would be. At first, the opening behind him cast dim white light ahead, and he could see yet more cars, jammed in bumper to bumper. It must have been bad dying in here, he thought, as claustrophobia wrapped its stealthy banana fingers lovingly around his head and began first to caress and then to squeeze his temples. It must have been really bad. It must have been fucking horrible. And the greenish-white tiles that dressed the upward-curving walls. He could see the pedestrian railing to his right stretching dimly ahead. On his left, at 30 or 40 foot intervals, were big support pillars. A sign advised him, "Do not change lanes." There were dark fluorescents embedded in the tunnel's roof and the blank glass eyes of the closed-circuit TV cameras. And as he negotiated the first slow banked curve, bearing gently to the right, the light grew dimmer until all he could see were muted flashes of chrome. After that, the light simply ceased to exist at all. He fumbled out his Bic, held it up, and spun the wheel. The light it provided was pitifully small, feeding his unease rather than assuaging it. Even with the flame turned up all the way, it only gave him a circle of visibility about 6 feet in diameter. He put it back in his pocket and kept walking, trailing his hand lightly along the railing. There was an echo in here, too, one he liked even less than the one outside. The echo made it sound like someone was behind him, stalking him. He stopped several times, head cocked, eyes wide, but blind, listening until the echo had died off. After a bit, he began to shuffle along, not lifting his heels from the concrete, so the echo wouldn't recur. Sometime after that, he stopped again and flicked the lighter close to his wristwatch. It was 4:20, but he wasn't sure what to make of that. In this blackness, time seemed to have no objective meaning. Neither did distance, for that matter. How long was the Lincoln Tunnel anyway? A mile? Two? Surely it couldn't be 2 miles under the Hudson River. Let's say a mile. But if a mile was all it was, he should have been at the other end already. If the average man walks 4 miles an hour, he can walk 1 mile in 15 minutes, and he'd already been in this stinking hole 5 minutes longer than that. "I'm walking a lot slower," he said, and jumped at the sound of his own voice. The lighter dropped from his hand and clicked onto the catwalk. The echo spoke back, changed into the dangerously jocular voice of an approaching lunatic. "Lot slower, lower, lower." "Jesus," Larry muttered, and the echo whispered back, "Zzz, zzz, zzz." He wiped a hand across his face, fighting panic and the urge to give up thought and just run blindly forward. Instead, he knelt, his knees popped like pistol shots, frightening him again, and walked his fingers over the miniature topography of the pedestrian catwalk, the chipped valleys in the cement, the ridge of an old cigarette butt, the hill of a tiny tinfoil ball, until at last he happened on his Bic. With an inner sigh, he squeezed it tightly in his hand, stood up, and walked on. Larry was beginning to get himself under control again when his foot struck something stiff and barely yielding. He uttered an inhalatory sort of scream and took two staggering steps backward. He made himself hold steady as he pulled the Bic lighter from his pocket and flicked it. The flame wavered crazily in his trembling grasp. He had stepped on a soldier's hand. He was sitting with his back against the tunnel wall, his legs splayed across the walkway, a horrible sentinel left here to bar passage. His glazed eyes stared up at Larry. His lips had fallen away from his teeth, and he seemed to be grinning. A switchblade knife jutted jauntily from his throat. The lighter was growing warm in his hand. Larry let it go out. Licking his lips, holding the railing in a death grip, he forced himself forward until the toe of his shoe struck the soldier's hand again. Then he stepped over, making a comically large stride, and a kind of nightmarish certainty came over him. He would hear the scrape of the soldier's boots as he shifted, and then the soldier would reach out and clasp his leg in a loose, cold grip. In a shuffling sort of run, Larry went another 10 paces and then made himself stop, knowing that if he didn't stop, the panic would win and he would bolt blindly, chased by a terrible regiment of echoes. When he felt he had himself under some sort of control, he began to walk again. But now it was worse. His toes shrank inside his shoes, afraid that at any second they might come in contact with another body sprawled on the catwalk. And soon enough, it happened. He groaned and fumbled the lighter out again. This time it was much worse. The body his foot had struck was that of an old man in a blue suit. A black silk skull cap had fallen from his balding head into his lap. There was a 6-pointed star of beaten silver in his lapel. Beyond him were another 6 corpses, 2 women, a man of middle age, a woman who might have been in her late 70s, 2 teenage boys. The lighter was growing too old to hot any longer. He snapped it off and slipped it back into his pants pocket, where it glowed like a warm coal against his leg. Captain Trips hadn't taken this group off any more than it had taken the soldier back there. He had seen the blood, the torn clothes, the chipped tiles, the bullet holes. They had been gunned down. Larry remembered the rumors that soldiers had blocked off the points of exit from Island Manhattan. He hadn't known whether to believe them or not. He had heard so many rumors last week as things were breaking down. The situation here was easy enough to reconstruct. They had been caught in the tunnel, but they hadn't been too sick to walk. They got out of their car and began to make their way toward the Jersey side, using the catwalk just as he was doing. There had been a command post, machine gun emplacement, something. Had been, or was now. Larry stood sweating, trying to make up his mind. The solid darkness provided the perfect theater screen on which the mind could play out its fantasies. He saw grim-eyed soldiers in germ-proof suits crouched behind a machine gun equipped with an infrared peeper scope, their job to cut down any stragglers who tried to come through the tunnel. One single soldier left behind, a suicide volunteer, wearing infrared goggles and creeping toward him with a knife in his teeth. 2 soldiers quietly loading a mortar with a single poison gas canister. Yet he couldn't bring himself to go back. He was quite sure that these imaginings were only vapors, and the thought of retracing his steps was insupportable. Surely the soldiers were now gone. The dead one he'd stepped over seemed to support that, but what was really troubling him, he supposed, were the bodies directly ahead. They were sprawled all over each other for 8 or 9 feet. He couldn't just step over them as he had stepped over the soldier. And if he went off the catwalk to go around them, he risked breaking his leg or his ankle. If he was to go on, he would have to, well, he would have to walk over them. Behind him, in the darkness, something moved. Larry wheeled around, instantly engulfed with fear at that single gritting sound. A footstep. "Who's there?" he shouted, unslinging his rifle. No answer but the echo. When it faded, he heard, or thought he did, the quiet sound of breathing. He stood bug-eyed in the dark, the hairs along the nape of his neck turning into hackles. He held his breath. There was no sound. He was beginning to dismiss it as imagination when the sound came again. A sliding, quiet footstep. He fumbled madly for his lighter. The thought that it would make him a target never occurred to him. As he pulled it from his pocket, the striker wheel caught on the lining momentarily, and the lighter tumbled from his hand. He heard a clink as it struck the railing, and then there was a soft bonk as it struck the hood or trunk of a car below. The sliding footstep came again, a little closer now, impossible to